Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino, and you are the whole show for today. You are the only case we have set for oral submission, so you will have our undivided attention. And understand both sides are ready?
We are, Justices.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If you'll call the case, we'll get started.
Kenneth L. Thompson versus Kate M. Thompson. May it please the court, Mr. Craig A. Jackson will argue for the appellant. Ms. Judith A. Grantham will argue for the appellate.
Correct.
May it please the court, and please bear with me. I've done a number of appeals. I've never had one where I actually had to do oral arguments, so I will do my best to meet with the rules of decorum and protocol, but I have Googled and searched online for a nuts and bolts, here's what you really ought to say during oral arguments, and everybody says that the oral arguments, those are just an afterthought.
They are not an afterthought. We gave you oral argument because we have questions. And you just start out and say, may it please the court, I am and I represent, and then you tell us briefly the facts of the case and the issues that you are going to talk about today, and
understood.
And we will ask our questions.
That was my plan. The who we are, I represent Kenneth Thompson. He's the appellant in this case. The underlying case is a divorce. It's a divorce coupled with a suit affecting the parent-child relationship. Kenneth is the respondent in that divorce. The petitioner in that case is Kate Outlaw, formerly Kate Thompson. She's Kate Thompson as of the filing of the divorce. She was Kate Outlaw after the divorce. What we want, we're asking the court to reverse and remand this case for a new trial. The why we should get it is because we meet the requirements of a restricted appeal. My client, he's a disabled vet, resides in Tifton, Georgia. The appellee/petitioner to the underlying divorce is a resident of Mansfield. The parties have one child, Olivia. She's 12 years old.
Why should we think he'll show up this time? We're not just wasting everybody's time.
Well, I anticipate that the case would be resolved. I don't think there's any super complicated issues in the case.
It's joint custody with the child continuing to live where the child has always lived.
Well, there's that, but there's also the issue of child support that's an issue. One of the issues is, and in fact, the court in the default judgment awarded about $24,000 in retroactive or child support arrearages that we believe there's no way possible for that to be supported by the evidence due to the fact that there are no prior orders, there were no temporary orders, there was no pleadings seeking a confirmation of an arrearage or any explanation for how there can be an arrearage in a divorce decree in which there's absolutely no prior obligation to support the child.
So this is about the amount of money he was ordered to pay.
That's one of the issues, absolutely. Additionally, my client being a disabled vet, if a new trial were to be granted, evidence would be presented regarding the child's benefits through the VA or the Social Security Administration, which should be, in a sense, a credit toward any child support obligation that would be imposed upon him for the future. That was not recognized in the default judgment taken against him, so in the event that a new trial is granted, there's a substantial likelihood that there will be a much different outcome with respect to the retroactive as well as the future support.
Why didn't he go back into court when he could have filed a motion for new trial?
It's my understanding that he was unaware of the entry of the final decree of divorce until well after the 30 days following the expiration of the trial court's plenary power. He hired me on the eve of and when I say the eve, I don't mean the very eve necessarily, but almost the eve of the expiration of the six-month period following the signing of the decree. And so this is really his only legal remedy that he had left to his to avail himself of.
Is there any case law that supports your position?
The position of Which exact position are you asking about the case law of? There's substantial amounts of case law supporting our position that in a default judgment, the lack of a record in the trial court is essentially a per se reversible error. The only cases and the only instances, and the appellee cites one case in which the failure to make a record was not reversible error, but that was a case in which both parties appeared at trial. In the cases that we cited, the Rogers case from the Supreme Court, the Stubbs case from the Supreme Court, a couple of cases from this court, the MEP case as well as the Bain case, default judgments that were rendered in SAPSRs without a trial court reporter's record, it was reversible error due to the fact that there's no way to have an appellate review of your case that's effective because there's no way to determine how the trial court ruled in the way that it did. In this case, I think this is on all four corners with the Rogers case by the Texas Supreme Court. In that case, you had a divorce coupled with a SAPSR in which a default judgment was taken. There was a, I think that was under the old writ of error nomenclature, which is the same as our restricted appeal today. The court found that the party who did not participate in the case, didn't file any post-judgment motions, didn't file a request for findings of fact, had presented error apparent on the face of the record because there was no trial court record or, a reporter's record in the trial court. This case is squarely on all four points or all four corners in line with the Rogers case. We have an appellant who did not participate in the case at trial. Didn't make an appearance at all. He didn't file any post-judgment motions, didn't file any requests for findings of fact or conclusions of law, but yet we have no reporter's record on which to look at to review the case here. So to answer your question, yes, the Rogers case and the Stubbs case support, Mr. Thompson's position as to every element of a restricted appeal.
And what court is the Stubbs case out of?
The Texas Supreme Court.
Which is the newer case?
I want to say that the Stubbs case is the newer case. Yeah, the Stubbs case is a 1985 case, and the Rogers case was a 78 case. But this court in the MEP case, as well as the Bain case, both of which were from the 2000s, in MEP, that was decided in 2006, and Bain was decided in 2007. They both rely on the Rogers case specifically, and I can't remember if the Stubbs case was cited in MEP and in Bain. But in every case that we've read and found, in a default judgment context, there has to be a record just because there's absolutely no other way to review the case on an appeal in the absence of that record. Now, the record can consist of clerk's record and the reporter's record if there's affidavits or some such that provide some factual some indication to the reviewing court that there was some factual or facts upon which to base a judgment. But we don't have that here. We don't have any affidavits. We don't have anything other than a petition for a divorce, which after the expiration of 60 days and the time that was required for my client to answer, a default judgment was granted.
Appley argues that because your client didn't appear, it was only necessary for her to waive the making of the record.
Well, that's not what the cases suggest. There's no requirement that a respondent or a defendant file an answer to a lawsuit. Now, there's a consequence for doing that, but there's not a requirement that they do that. And if they ill-advisedly fail to answer a lawsuit, the consequence of that is a default judgment can be taken. Now, however, due process mandates that that default judgment conform to the pleadings and to the evidence. And the only way to determine whether that evidence was present is to have a record. Now, if you take that logic a step further, what she's proposing is that in any default judgment, there is no need for a reporter's record. And if that were the case, if you have a default judgment that you might can take advantage of, there's absolutely nothing to prevent someone from, let's say, sticking a decree in front of a trial judge that says $100,000 per month in child support is in the child's best interest. Or you can make it $1 million a month. You wouldn't have any way to challenge the sufficiency of the evidence. If a would-be child support payor / respondent were to receive a notice from the clerk saying divorce decree has been finalized, there's been a final judgment, and in accordance with Rule 306 or 329, you're put on notice that a final judgment has been signed. You go to the courthouse, you get a copy of that judgment, and you read, well, I knew she was going to take a default judgment against me, but I'm ordered to pay $100,000 a month in child support. There's absolutely no way that that is supported in the record, let's say, for a guy that's on disability, such as my client. Under the appellee's theory, he really would be without recourse to go in front of this court and say, I knew she was going to take a default against me, but at $1 million a month in child support, there's no way that's supported by the record when I only make $20,000-$25,000 a year. The argument that you waive an objection or waive appellate review to the lack of a record in any case that there's a default judgment isn't supported by the case law, due process, or common sense.
You attached a copy of Family Code Section 105.003 to your brief, and it provides that a record shall be made in civil cases generally unless waived by the parties with the consent of the court. Would you and the title says Procedure for Contested Hearing. Are you relying on that section as well?
That is one of the sections that we're relying on, as well as 13.1 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure, and as well as the cases that interpret both of those, as well as the cases that just, take the Rogers case, for example. It doesn't provide any other specific statutory authority other than the family code provisions, and at the time I believe it was 11 point something before the reshuffling and recodification of the family code. But in light of the fact that this is a SAPSR, yes, that is one of the grounds upon which we're relying.
Since this was a default judgment, would it still qualify as a contested hearing?
Well, I don't see why it would not. That's in the title of the particular statute. The cases before us that apply that to default judgments would seem to suggest that it is applicable in a default judgment setting. Reading the actual substance of the statute mentions nothing about contested cases. I think that the distinction between contested and not contested could be that a contested case is one in which there's not an agreement, and a contested case or an uncontested case is one in which there is an agreement. There was clearly no agreement here because my client was absent. I think it would fall within the purview of 105.003 as a result.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? Anything else?
I think there's nothing else. My yellow light's on, so I will, even though we have the whole afternoon, I think I'll defer the rest of my time.
Thank you. Judith?
Honorable Justices, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court. My name is Judith Grantham. I'm here on behalf of Kate Outlaw, formerly known as Kate Thompson. And while the appellant wishes this court to take a simplistic view of this issue, we feel that it is much more complex and has been addressed by some of the questions by this panel to appellant's counsel. At issue, and only at issue, is Section 105.003 of the Texas Family Code. And we believe the appellant's position is that this is very simple. The facts of this case are that Ms. Outlaw filed a petition for divorce in the state of Texas in early 2012. The record, the clerk's record in this case, shows that Mr. Thompson resided in the state of Georgia, that he did nothing to respond to that petition, enter an appearance, sign a waiver, come forward, do anything. Then it was incumbent upon Ms. Thompson, then Ms. Thompson, now Ms. Outlaw, to file an amended petition. And if we are looking at what could happen on remand, is what we believe is going to happen on remand, is that Mr. Thompson avoided service, did nothing for 16 months. 16 months.
We're not a jury.
Okay.
So a motion doesn't cut any ice here.
16 months. He did nothing for 16 months while this case was pending. And then on the very last day, that 16 months includes the very last day to file this restricted appeal, after that default judgment was entered in the trial court. If you look at the clerk's record, you will surmise, I believe, and it is my position before this honorable panel, that Ms. Outlaw moved from the state of Georgia with the child and had to reside in the state of Texas at least 6 months prior to filing the petition for divorce. Mr. Jackson argued that his client is disabled. Ms. Thompson is now receiving $1,031 in monthly benefits through the VA. That is, the evidence is going to show, if this is remanded, that Mr. Thompson was collecting and not forwarding to the mother for the support of the child. Thus is the basis of a $21,000.
But that's not in the record before us, so we can't go outside the record.
What we want this court to do is look at the legislative intent of Section 105.003. And in my brief, that it is, and as Justice Gardner asked, is the procedure for a contested hearing. I do not and cannot comprehend how a default is a contested hearing. There isn't much case law on this point. There are two Supreme Court cases, the Stubbs case in 1985, which Mr. Jackson cites in his brief. There is the Rogers case in 1978. Those date back to Section 11.14D of the Texas Family Code. That also refers to specific sections in the civil procedure, which is no longer, those have been superseded. The Rogers case is particularly applicable because the Supreme Court says, and it's our position that the appellant has misquoted Rogers, the Supreme Court holding says requires due diligence, that the defaulting party, through due diligence and through no fault of their own, was unable to secure a record. Where is the due diligence, and our emphasis is on no fault of his own? How?
If your argument were the case, then no one who ever defaulted could effectively have a restricted appeal, because the person who was there would always have the impetus to waive the record so that there couldn't be any attack on the sufficiency of the evidence. So what is the, why even have a restricted appeal? If they can't use it because there's a waiver of the record, then what's the point of even having that right?
And that's a valid question. That's a valid question, Justice Gabriel. My position is, what is the legislature telling us that we're required to do? Is it the trial court's burden to protect the defaulting scofflaw party, Or is it the responsible party to protect the defaulting party by making a record? Certainly, it is. I was not trial counsel. I wasn't there. Mr. Jackson wasn't there. So we don't know why it was that it came about that there was no record.
Not only did it come about that there was no record, but the judgment itself says there was a record.
So and that's the essence of their simplistic complaint, is that the face of the record says there was a record made. Admittedly, somebody should have stricken through that and said a record was waived. That wasn't done. But again, neither one of us were there. So the question to me before this court is, whose responsibility is it under Section 105.003 to protect the rights of a defaulting party? Is it the trial court's responsibility? Is it the responsible parties who's there and present to preserve their right to a record?
Ultimately, it's the trial court that gets reversed. It's not the petitioner who was there. It's the trial court who committed the error.
And I'm asking, correct, and I'm asking the court to really look at this, the opinion that was handed down by this court in In Re DJM.
The facts are an apposite to this case because both parties were there and both parties waived the making of the record in that case. So that, I don't know how you can, that's an apple and this is an orange. I don't know how you compare them.
And that is the essence of why I'm asking the court to look at the legislative intent behind Section 105.003 as a contested hearing.
What if we don't find that 105.003 necessarily applies to this, but nevertheless case law applies and the rules concerning restricted appeals apply, and the cases that say you can't take a default and not support in your hearing what's awarded in the judgment, because there's a plethora of cases that say that.
Okay, then it is my position, Justice Gabriel, that this court has an obligation to send a clear message to both the bar and the judiciary, the trial judiciary, to say, I don't care if Mr. Thompson or Mr. X or Miss X or whomever in a SAPSR fails to appear, you have to have your court reporter present and you have to make a record. And in case Mr. Thompson or Mr. X or Miss S or Mr. whomever comes forward and said, you know, I didn't like the outcome, so I wanted to have this looked at, okay? I think this court has an obligation to do that. And if that's what this court feels like it needs to do, then I'm all for that. I'm all for that. Okay. The other thing that I would like to point out is, if that is this court's position, to make it clear to both the bar and the trial judiciary that a record is required. In this case, you can't go back, you can't remand it on the issue of the divorce. It was grounded on insupportability. If you apply Section 105.003, all we're talking about is the SAPSR issues. All we're talking about is the SAPSR issues. So if you remand this for a new trial, you're talking about, should there be joint managing conservatorship or sole managing conservatorship? Well, Mr. Thompson, who lives in Georgia, got the benefit of the doubt on that one. Child support, what is categorized in the judgment, and I agree with Mr. Jackson, it's categorized in the judgment as child support arrearages, should be retroactive child support. So that's really what we're talking about. I think he got a standard possession order. I don't see how there can be any more clear-cut issues on those things. So if this court is inclined to make that and send that clear message to us and the trial courts, that we need to make a record in each and every single case, then this court can only remand this case on the issues regarding the SAPSR, regarding the child.
So that's what you're asking us to do if we remand, if we... I don't see the Supreme Court gives us any alternative. I think they've made their position very, very clear. And if they want to reverse their position, they have to do it. I don't think we can reverse the Supreme Court. But you're saying remand only on the SAPSR.
This is a hard issue for me because I tend to disagree that I don't think Roger stands for the case that you just get to, and I don't think NRA DJM stands for the allowance that a litigant can lay behind the log and do nothing. I think the Supreme Court says you have to show us some reason why you didn't do anything. There's nothing in the record that says that. So I'm inclined to say no. But at the same time, yes, if you remand this case, I absolutely agree with the panel that those are the limited issues upon which it can be remanded.
No.
Thank you.
Is there a rebuttal?
Very briefly.
Counsel has, in her brief and in her argument today, accused my client of laying behind the log. And I think the case that she cited for that proposition is either the DJM or the MEP case. I think it was the DJM case, in which both parties showed up at the proceedings. And the court, this court, defined laying behind the log as essentially inviting error. In other words, there was a hearing in that particular case. The trial was held in front of the associate judge down the street, and in front of the associate judge, which doesn't typically have court reporters on cases other than enforcement cases, they agreed to waive the district judge hearing the case, and they proceeded to the final trial in front of the associate judge, and in front of the associate judge essentially put on their case, and neither side requested or made mention of the fact that there wasn't a court reporter on the case until after a decree was signed. So in that particular case, this court said that you can't just lay behind the log and essentially invite error and keep your mouth shut. That constitutes a waiver. And importantly in that case, though, this court said we do not find that the appellant was even laying behind the log, and that it was in fact, the court said specifically no indication exists that the appellant was intentionally lying behind the log in this case, but we declined to make a ruling that would promote invited error in the future. My client didn't do anything to invite error in the future in this case. He simply didn't file an answer and didn't appear at a default hearing in which he was given no notice. And contrary to the comments about my client waiting 16 months, the record will reflect that he was only served about 25 days before he was defaulted. There was a petition on file. He wasn't served for quite a while after the case was filed, and then they took a default judgment at just about the earliest possible moment. But all that's... I think the case law is clear that it has to be remanded as to the entire case. I think the 105.003 applies to the SAPSR portion of the case, but I think Rogers and Stubbs and this court's opinion in various other cases, you know, the Bain case, which is interesting, and in fact, I believe Justice Gardner was involved in that case. It was not a family law case at all. But in civil cases in general, there's still the right to have a record made when a default judgment is taken against you. So to the extent that 105.003 does not apply, I think you still have the requirements of Rule 13.1.
So you're saying that a divorce can be final, the person can be remarried because the divorce is final, be remarried, have gone on with their new married life, and the divorce itself can be reheard even though it's final?
Well, absolutely, I think that it can. Now, is there, I guess most people don't think of courts of appeal as applying rules of equity in the same way that you might in the trial courts, but that very well may be a situation in that some equitable rationale for rendering a decision might matter in an appeal. But yeah, there are certainly cases that divorces are granted and then essentially parties are undivorced by virtue of what a court of appeals does. In Re Pollard is one such case in which there was a divorce that was granted, and then there was a reversal and a remand of the entire case back to the trial court, and then one of the parties ultimately died. And the question in the probate court was whether the parties were effectively undivorced, and the Court of Appeals in that particular case said absolutely, the reversal and the remand was not without qualification. Now, Mr. Thompson in this case would have no objection to leaving the divorce in place, and I don't know that oral argument's the right time to make that concession procedurally. This is my first time here, so I have no problem with leaving them divorced, but the rest of the relief granted in the final decree of divorce is subject to reversal.
So you only want us to reverse on the SAPSR?
And the divorce, the division of the property related to the divorce, which is probably one of the lesser issues in terms of actual real impact on the party's lives.
I thought you said the only question was child support, so now you're saying it's also division of property?
If I said that, I misspoke. You have essentially a divorce decree that dissolves the party's marriage. Then you have the SAPSR portion of the decree, and then you have the division of the marital estate. If I indicated that the division of the marital estate was not an issue, then I grossly misspoke. The granting of the divorce is not an issue to us, but the relief granted in the divorce decree outside of the dissolution of the marriage is an issue.
Any other questions? All right, thank you. Your case is submitted. We appreciate your argument today. It's a very interesting issue. You're free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.